Anyway, it's 9 o'clock on a Thursday night. It is time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. And unfortunately, we start tonight's newscast on a sad note. Rest in peace. Redwood Forest defender Harold Short has died. Lived in Coralitos and basically kept watch on the forest down there. Harold knew that taking photos of logging on private forest land was risky, yet sometimes it was so effective that it was necessary. His photos once uncovered some of the worst stream damage caused by a logging boom in the early 1990s in the Santa Cruz Mountains. Harold's efforts forced government reviews, fines, and greater accountability. And the editor of the Forest Policy Research says that most of all, he could remember how Harold was always quietly sitting at the head of the table. At our monthly forest monitoring meetings, he was always composed, if not downright stoic, when we discussed the various outrages or plans for litigation against an industry that had wrought great harm to our local watersheds. To an outside observer, Harold might not have seemed very involved in those meetings, but to those of us who saw the quality of his work, we knew that he was a key player whose presence will be sorely missed. And here's another remembrance from Ida Hills, longtime forest advocate here in Santa Cruz on the Sierra Club Forestry Task Force. She writes, "Harold Short was a quiet man with a ready sense of humor. Whenever a person or group needed help with a special project, Harold was there. He was particularly active in when the Sierra Club Forestry Task Force, of which he was a longtime member, was protecting the redwoods of Ramsey Gulch and Grizzly Flat. Harold was a photographic engineer and taught photography in Carmel. His particular focus was on the dramatic natural view. Harold died on February 2nd in the Watsonville Hospital. He was 69. Whenever a special project needed help or needs help, Harold will be missed." And once again, that remembrance from Ida Hills. And Uncle Dennis will also miss Harold. So I hope you're in a beautiful growth grove, Harold. Hang out and watch the marble murrelets fly. Here's an announcement for this weekend. The California Native Plant Society, Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration Team, will be having one of their Saturday restorations this Saturday, February 21st, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. There's been lots of wonderful rain recently. We'll work several of the trails and continue with our French broom pulling efforts. It should be excellent soil conditions for broom pulling at the ranch. With moist habitat, we should hear tree frogs, maybe see newts and salamanders. Hope to see you all there. The Pacific chorus frog, also known as the Pacific tree frog, is perhaps the most abundant amphibian on the west coast of North America. The geographic range of these little frogs extends from British Columbia to Baja California and from the Pacific Ocean to Nevada and Montana. Within this huge area, Pacific chorus frogs can be found from sea level to well over 10,000 feet in habitats that include the deserts and the redwood forests. And yes, you will hear frogs in the forest these days. On directions on how to get to this this Saturday's habitat restoration in Quail Hollow County Ranch County Park, take Graham Hill Road north from Santa Cruz. As you come down in the hill of the fountain, turn right at the first light onto East Ziani Road. Go up a couple of miles, turn left onto Quail Hollow Road. Another half a mile up on the right is the entrance to the park, and they will meet in the gravel parking lot on the left side of the entrance road. The Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitats in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. The program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Wear comfortable layered clothing. Bring something to drink and lots of enthusiasm. And I hope one of those layers this Saturday probably is going to have to be a raincoat. They do work rain or shine, but if things get particularly unpleasant, they'll call it a day. Tools are provided, but remember to bring your gloves and some water. For more information, contact the program leader, Linda. Her number, 831-462-4041. That's 462-4041. You could send her an email at redwoodrn, that's REDWDRN at packbell.net, or visit their webpage, www.cruzcnps.org. That's CRUZCNPS.org. And in Australia, East Gippsland Forest defenders win a 2-week reprieve due to a rare species find. Anti-logging campaigners have won a 2-week reprieve in Far East Gippsland after claiming to have discovered 4 threatened species in old-growth forest earmarked for harvesting. Scientists working on behalf of Environment East Gippsland say a survey last weekend found endangered glider, owl, and crayfish species in a forest on forest coop on Brown Mountain. Australian Greens leader Bob Brown said it was outrageous that it was left to self-appointed forest defenders to survey the area for threatened species. The Department of Sustainability and Environment must be hanging its head with shame. These are the fabulous Victorian wildlife, and the Brumby government is aiding and abetting their onrush toward extinction, he said. Senator Brown called on the federal government to investigate whether Victoria had breached the regional forest agreement by allowing rare and endangered species to be destroyed. Bureaucrats responding by ordering logging to be delayed for at least a fortnight while claims of a large population of greater gliders was investigated. These are small rodent-like flying squirrel kind of things. But Vic Forest, the state-owned commercial forestry business, cast doubt over some of the claims. Its regional manager, Barry Vaughn, said a crayfish specimen presented by conservationists was not the endangered Orbst spiny crayfish, but a relatively common Bittawal spiny crayfish. Despite this, a precautionary 100-meter buffer would be placed around a rainforest creek as a precaution, he said. He said two owl species, the sooty and powerful owls, had access to ample protected vegetation in adjacent native forest. The claims are worthy of investigation, but we are confident that harvesting will continue, Mr. Vaughn said. I'm not so sure about that one. Here is the Buffalo Field Campaign update from the field for February 12th. Sorry this is late, but we didn't have a show last week, so. Since a lone bull came wandering across the hills and gullies of Yellowstone National Park's northern boundary on November 15th and was promptly shot, there hasn't been a single wild buffalo in Montana. Buffalo Field Campaign has been taking advantage of this atypical downtime by working double time in the legal and policy areas. With our singular focus on providing Yellowstone buffalo unimpeded access to their habitat in Montana, we need your help. With a new administration in Washington, positive change for the buffalo has never been more promising. But we must let President Obama know that the wild Yellowstone buffalo, their importance, and what he can do to stop the slaughter. If you haven't already done so, please take a moment to send a letter to President Barack Obama using Buffalo Field Campaign's new Take Action Center. You'll find that at their webpage, and we'll give you that in a minute. If you've already sent one yourself, please share the letter with your family members, friends, and acquaintances. President Obama has already received nearly 800 letters for the buffalo. It is up to each of us to make sure he hears from thousands more. On a more local level, the Buffalo Field Campaign representatives traveled to Helena, Montana recently to testify in favor of Montana House Bill 253, the Montana Wild Buffalo Recovery and Conservation Act of 2009, which would have removed Bison Management Authority from the Department of Livestock and invested it with the Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. Many of you who are Montana residents contacted your representatives in support of this bill. While the overwhelming majority of speakers at the hearing supported the legislation, the Montana Stock Growers Association, Boohoo, opposed it, and it was tabled in committee, meaning it is unlikely to come up for a vote. Attorneys for the Montana Board of Livestock and Earth Justice recently filed motions to dismiss a second complaint filed by the Montana Stock Growers. The stock growers claim recent additions to the Interagency Bison Management Plan allowing bison to migrate outside of Yellowstone National Park in Hebgen Basin violates their constitutional rights to a clean and healthful environment. Bosh. The stock growers also claim a proper environmental analysis was not prepared before changes were made to the bison plan. This is the first season that the state of Montana and several federal agencies agreed to adapt changes in the bison plan to allow bison to roam seasonally on Horse Butte Peninsula, a bison wintering and calving ground spread over 9,600 acres of habitat. That change was recently undermined by Forest Supervisor Mary Erickson's decision to renew the Montana Department of Livestock's permit to operate a bison trap on Gallatin National Forest lands in Horse Butte for another 10 years, however. There's justice representing local Horse Butte residents argued there is no legal duty for the state of Montana to kill or remove bison by May 15th every year who have roamed a range outside of Yellowstone National Park. Local residents who intervened in the stock growers' suit want wild bison on private and public lands in the Hebgen Basin without government harassment. The nonprofit lawyers argue that the bison plan is adaptive and Montana law is permissive in how bison can be managed. They were joined by Assistant Attorney General Norman Peterson, representing the Board of Livestock, who asked the court to dismiss the suit as stock growers lack standing to sue and are not a party to the bison plan. Earth Justice also filed a motion to change the court venue, arguing the stock growers' claim of alleged injury can only arise in Gallatin County, as bison are confined to zones outlined in the adaptive plan that do not permit them to roam in Madison County, where the stock growers' complaint was filed. If you want more information, contact the Buffalo Field Campaign. Their website, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And when you do visit the website, they do have a page dedicated to things that they need. And, of course, money is one of them. So if you can figure out what to send them, send it to the Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, the zip 59758. Once again, that webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And remember, the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And here is the forest update for February of 2009, prepared by Jody Frediani, a consultant to the Sierra Club Forestry Task Force. In June of 2008, the city of Watsonville submitted an NTMP, that's a non-industrial timber management plan for 184 acres in the Rattlesnake and Shingle Mill Creek drainages, also known as Grizzly Flat. That's right, Grizzly Flat is back. However, the initial NTMP application was returned for deficiencies on June 30th, but resubmitted to Cal Fire on February 3rd. It will undergo, it underwent its first review on February 11th. The registered professional forester does state that no trees were killed or substantially damaged in the summit fire and has addressed at least 28 items identified when the NTMP was returned as needing correction or clarification. And you can always go and check that out on the Cal Fire FTP page. That's ftp://thp.fire.ca.gov/thplibrary. And you can go from there to figure it out. We're part of the North Coast area, and NTMPs for 2008 is where you'll look. Right next door is the Eureka Gulch West Timber Harvest Plan, and that's THP 108-159, Santa Cruz County. Redwood Empire has a timber harvest plan under review along Buzzard Lagoon Road in the Corralitos area. The plan is 196 acres, and it has 20, that's 20, Class 3 watercourses, 10 Class 2 watercourses. There are 46 landslides in the plan area, and it was harvested under two different timber harvest plans in the late 1990s. In fact, one area was harvested for redwoods as recently as 2001. The registered professional forester writing the plan, Michael Duffy, has proposed no cutoff in winter operations. He includes all sorts of directions, confusing at best and misleading at worst about when crews can operate and when they cannot. Ground-based operations will stop for 10 days after a quarter inch of rain, but then can commence if soils are not saturated. There are different dates for different activities. He has also proposed a host of in-lieu practices, including in-lieu tree marking in the Watercourse Lake Protection Zone, operations on steep slopes, in-lieu felling of trees in the Watercourse Lake Protection Zone, and tractor operations in cable yarding areas, and on and on and on. There is a U.S. There is a water restriction for Coralitos Creek called a TMDL, total maximum daily load for sediment, which has identified roads as the main contributing source of sediment with an expectation of a 95% reduction in the sediment load. The registered professional forester incorrectly stated that neither Coralitos Creek nor Eureka Gulch were 303D listed for sediment, and the previous harvests on this site have had landing failures, one where drainage created a gully 15 feet wide, 10 feet long, and 10 feet deep. Now, if you do the math, that's an awful lot of cubic feet of sediment. As well as a road crossing washed out, leaving a chasm approximately 25 feet wide and 22 feet high. And there's other things that were wrong with that one. Well, the good news is the Santa Cruz County and Department of Fish and Game have both filed non-concurrences on this plan, and the Sierra Club, in conjunction with the Central Coast Forest Watch, submitted a 7-page letter asking that the plan be denied. We'll keep you up to date on that one, and we thank Jody Frediani for her forest updates. Moving to Australia again, forest defenders being sued in return the favor by suing the loggers who sued them. A group of forest activists being sued over a protest at Gunn's Triabunna Woodchip Mill have lodged a counterclaim against the timber company. Gunn's is seeking damages from 13 protesters who chained themselves to machinery at its Triabunna Mill last December. The activists have lodged their defense in the Supreme Court at Launceston, and also served a counterclaim on Gunn's seeking an injunction. One of the activists, Warwick Jordan, says the group is alleging Gunn's made misleading representations. The claim is focusing on the fact that Gunn's Limited has said that no old-growth forest and no old-growth logs will be used in its pulp mill, he said. The Gunn's spokesman has rejected the protesters' allegations as typically wild and inaccurate. He has described the claim as vexatious, saying the company has made a public commitment not to use old-growth logs in the proposed mill. And another 550 people have done direct action to halt ancient forest logging in Tasmania. The tussle over the future of an old-growth forest in Tasmania is continuing, with 550 protesters marching along the logging road today. Environmentalists say they once again blocked the road into the Upper Florentine Valley, which is west of Hobart along the edge of Tasmania's wild southwest region. They have used tree sits and cars to blockade the road and are now waiting to see if Forestry Tasmania or the police will try to remove them. Ali Alicia, spokesman for the protest group Still Wild, Still Threatened, said the mood at Saturday's protest was positive. It was really morale-boosting for the people in the trees, Mr. Alicia said. Campaigner Jack Lomax said in the next 3 weeks, action would be stepped up at Forestry Tasmania's Melville Street office, and he urged people to turn out in force and defy police instructions to move on. The former face of the Wilderness Society, Jeffrey Law, was one of several speakers who addressed the group that gathered before the walk up to the controversial 4-kilometer logging road into the logging area. When the bulldozers came back here, I will be back, and I hope you will be too. Mr. Law said as a protest action heated up in the forest and in the city. Gathering was made up of people from all walks of life and all ages, including many first-time protesters. Dodges Ferry retiree Larissa Dinar said she had never participated in forest actions but had been encouraged to attend by a friend. You know, you read all the stories and see the pictures, but it's not until you come here and see the destruction just from building a logging road that you realize, Ms. Dinar said. I am just amazed that someone could do this. I urge all people to come and see it for themselves and experience the calm and peace before they make up their mind. No police or Forestry Tasmania employees attended yesterday, but when they return, they will find a new intricate tree sit blocking the road. An old Datsun B180 has been given a new lease on life as the protest aid. It has been chained and buried across the road that will be used to log the forest. On the other side, an underground protest chamber is being built. The action came on the same day Wilderness Society spokesman Vika Bailey received word that the Forest Industry Association of Tasmania has declined an invitation to attend a community debate on forestry issues. And a court has canceled the Environmental Protection Agency clean water exemption for pesticides in this story by the Environmental News Service. Environmental groups are celebrating their victory as an appeals court vacated a U.S. EPA rule that has allowed pesticides to be applied to United States waters without a Clean Water Act permit. On November 27th of 2007, the EPA issued the final rule, which states that pesticides applied in accordance with federal pesticide, insecticide, and fungicide and rodenticide act, or FIFRA, are exempt from the Clean Water Act's permitting requirements. The Clean Water Act regulates the discharge of pollutants into the nation's waters by, among other things, requiring entities that emit pollutants to obtain a national pollutant discharge elimination system permit. For nearly 30 years before the adoption of the rule, pesticide labels issued under FIFRA were required to contain a notice stating that the pesticides could not be discharged into lakes, streams, ponds, or public waters unless in accordance with an NPDES permit. Two different groups of petitioners, one representing environmental interest groups and the other representing industry interest groups, for different reasons opposed the rule as exceeding the EPA's interpretive authority. The EPA defends the rule by arguing that the terms of the Clean Water Act are ambiguous and that a rule is a reasonable construction of the Clean Water Act. In their decision, the three-judge panel of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals wrote, "We cannot agree. The Clean Water Act is not ambiguous. Therefore, we hold that the EPA's final rule is not a reasonable interpretation of the Act, and we therefore vacate the final rule." The decision was a victory for clean water and for fish and wildlife, declared Charlie Tebbett, Western Environmental Law Center attorney and lead counsel for the environmental organizations and organic farms that challenged the rule. This decision is another in a long line of rebukes to the Bush administration policies that overstepped their statutory authority and to the chemical manufacturers who peddled their poisons without concern to the effects on human health and the environment, said Tebbett. "We look forward to working with the new EPA to protect the environment rather than the chemical industry." With the intention of broadening the EPA exemption, the industry argued that the EPA rule is arbitrary and capricious because it treats pesticides applied in violation of the FIFRA as pollutants, while it treats the very same pesticides used in compliance with FIFRA as non-pollutants. The court denied their claim and ruled that pesticide residues and biological pesticides constitute pollutants under federal law and therefore must be regulated under the Clean Water Act in order to minimize the impact to human health and the environment. This decision will help ensure that communities across the country that adequate pests are addressed, that aquatic pests are addressed in ways that protect both water quality and the public health, said Chuck Caldart of the National Environmental Law Center, one of the attorneys representing the plaintiffs. "We're thrilled by the court's decision, particularly in providing clarity on the aerial application of pesticides over navigable waters for mosquito control," said Peconic Baykeeper Kevin McAllister. "Ensuring that the required discharge permits have been obtained provides a greater protection of our water resources." Time and time again, during these past 8 years, EPA has walked into the federal courts and tried to defend absolutely indefensible rules like the one vacated today, said Waterkeeper Alliance legal director Scott Edwards. "Time and again, they've been sent back to the drawing boards to rewrite these unlawful rules. Hopefully, EPA's days of pandering to the industry and other polluters and wasteful taxpayers' dollars in illegal rulemaking have drawn to a welcome close. This is a significant victory for our nation's waters. More than 8 million pounds of pesticides, that's 8 million pounds of pesticides, are applied each year in the Bay Area alone," said Sajal Chosky, program director for San Francisco Baykeeper. "These toxic chemicals enter our creeks, harming numerous species of fish, frogs, and other aquatic life, and now will be regulated under the Clean Water Act." Steve Pedry, Oregon Wild Conservation Director, said, "When it comes to toxic pesticides and their effects on our rivers and salmon, we need to be certain that good science is being used and those resources are being protected. This ruling is a victory for clean water and fish and a victory for Americans who care about healthy rivers and streams." And moving to Northern California, The McLeod Ranch development threatens willow flycatchers. A developer from Chico, California, has proposed a 93-acre development in the McLeod Meadows Ranch, which would pin one of the last known breeding pairs of willow flycatchers in the McLeod region between a road, a subdivision, and a golf course. The willow flycatcher is a small yellowish-gray bird that makes its living in willow and alder thickets along riverbanks. Once numerous in California's lowlands, the willow flycatcher has been forced to retreat to higher elevations as residential development and livestock grazing have destroyed most of their prime habitat. In 1990, the state of California listed the willow flycatcher as an endangered species. Leaving aside for the moment where these 61 families would get their home financing in this credit market, what effect they'd have on McLeod's net rural character, and what combined effect they would have on the water table when added to the still possible Nestle bottled water facility, and what effect dozens of house cats moving next door to an endangered songbird, we must first concern ourselves with whether McLeod Meadows Ranch is following the law. Calamus Siskiyou Wild and the California Department of Fish and Game have made compelling arguments that the project will have significant impact on the environment and thus require a full environmental impact report before proceeding. If you want further information, go to www.kswild.org. And moving to Washington, and there have been 116 landslides in a 6-mile stretch of the overlogged Glenoma area. In a 6-mile stretch of hillsides north of Glenoma, Washington, the State Department of Natural Resources aerial surveys have tallied 116 slides. Nearly 80% of those came from lands logged in the past 20 years or roads built to access the timber, according to Seattle Times analyst Mark Hornby, who left a construction management job in Utah to return to his family's farm in this Cascade Mountain Valley. He wanted to raise cattle and his two young daughters on land his grandfather once cleared with mules. During the intense rainstorms 2 weeks ago, a clear-cut slope behind the farm gave way. A chocolate-covered wave of mud, stumps, and slash killed three of his calves, tore down fencing, and enveloped most of the pasture. Another slide funneled into a creek as Hornby and his younger brother John were trying to clear a culvert. They got out of the way minutes before the slide blew through. "It's been pretty devastating," said Hornby, 27, who estimates the farm sustained several $100,000 in damage. "I had this beautiful master plan for the farm that we could raise natural beef, but this wasn't in the plan." Landslides in the Upper Cowlitz Valley cost an estimated $4.5 million in private property damage, destroyed 8 homes, and struck dozens of other properties, including a tavern, a golf course, and a fish farm that lost more than 200,000 Arctic char and steelhead. Many mud-struck property owners can look at the nearby hillsides and spot the log sides where the slides originated. Some of the property owners are looking to the timber companies for help to rebuild. "I know this wasn't an intentional thing," Hornsby said, "but I want my farm back. I want everything restored." Timber companies aren't about to shoulder the blame for everything that happened. Their representatives note that the trigger for the landslides was a huge amount of rain dumped on the mountains at a time when deep snow piled up even on lower slopes. They add that there were plenty of slides in older, more intact forests all across southwest Washington. And unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for news this week. If you'd like to hear a podcast of this week's Earth First Update or of a previous Earth First Update, you can go to the following webpage, www.h2opodcast.com. That's www.h2opodcast.com. When you get there, click on Earth and then select Earth First Radio. And we thank the folks at H2O Podcast for recording and providing Earth First Updates for our listeners. The Earth First Update is presented each Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis, your host. I invite you to tune back in next Thursday evening for another Earth First Update.